Flowers.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case, Grace and Raymond Kadoukas. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The facts of this business dispute gone sour are lengthy and complex, but they can be succinctly stated for the purposes of this appeal. The whole scenario begins in 1994 when the plaintiff, Grace Kadoukas, was induced to join a venture by a defendant, Simmons. She was introduced to two other defendants, Mansinkas and Pekkas, both of whom had their origins in Lithuania, as did the plaintiff and her son, plaintiff Raymond Kadoukas. Their intent was to open the first fast food restaurant in the country of Lithuania, a country that had just recently been liberated from Soviet rule. It was a very exciting proposal for them at the time. On October 1st, 1994, a corporation was formed in Ohio called American Chicken of Vilnius. The shareholders split up the shares with Grace and Raymond Kadoukas receiving 60 shares, and Mansinkas and Pekkas, the other two, receiving 70 shares. A conveyance agreement was adopted, which stated therein that a licensing agreement was appended thereto as Exhibit A. And the way this worked was that the Kadoukases contributed money. The other two, Mansinkas and Pekkas, contributed a little bit of money, but they were also to supply the licensing agreement to make up for the lack of funds that they were producing.
Counsel, what is the underlying fraud that your client bases this action on?
The fraud arises from a series of events from 94 on through, most notably forging documents and not disclosing it to the clients, taking distributions and not disclosing it to the plaintiffs.
Okay, and the statute of limitations is what?
4 years.
So, and this case was filed when?
February 1st, 2001.
So it would only be events that occur after?
February 1st, 1997 and beyond. So within that time,
you started talking about fraud that occurred before.
I was almost there to February 1st, 1997. And what I was going to say is at that point in time and afterwards, we have Mansinkas receiving a $3,000 payment on January 12th, 1998. He receives a $6,750 distribution on January 22nd, 1998. Pekkas received on the same date his own distribution for $6,250. The other two shareholders, my clients, received nothing. On September 18th,
well, does your cause, is this case about the statute of limitations for fraud action?
I hope so, yes.
All right. Your complaint, does it allege fraud that occurred before the magic date?
The complaint alleges fraud. And it starts with the events in 94.
Well, that's a fairly simple question.
Correct. And I'll try to answer it. It does start with events that occurred before 94 and continues onwards. The complaint only describes one scenario, and it's a scenario dealing with the license agreement. Because at the time the complaint is written, it wasn't known that there had been forged resolutions in 2000. It wasn't known that there had been distributions to these guys without similar distributions to the plaintiffs. None of this was known. So the complaint describes the franchise agreement 94, and that's the only scenario that's in there. So what the 8th District does is say, we're not going to look at this evidence you have of fraud past February 1st, 1997, because all your complaint talks about specifically is this franchise agreement, and you're stuck with that. And that's the part that we have trouble with, because this idea that the complaint sets the initial parameters from which the lawsuit cannot exceed is a novel issue since the adoption of the new civil rules in 1970. I mean, the court's reasoning is summed up in a sentence, which I find startling.
But I mean, didn't you create the problem, the litigation problem, by trying to drag in fraud that's occurred prior? You know the statute of limitations when you file this.
Correct.
I mean, didn't you set up the trouble in this case by talking about things that occur principally, apparently, about things that occur before the magic date?
I disagree. The discussion of the franchise agreement was nothing more than setting the background. I mean, because there's a statute of limitations, that doesn't mean you can't talk about stuff back there.
Well, sure.
The scenario wouldn't make any sense unless
but,
you
I mean,
say
if,
how these
if,
people
if
got
you've
together.
Got a statute of limitations problem, it seems it would be helpful to the courts that are going to be looking at this to say, look, these are the things that occurred at this point. We're putting that in for informational purposes, but the cause of action that we bring you are the frauds and the damage to my client that has occurred within the time allowed for bringing such a case.
Correct. I mean, I understand if you're saying the complaint could be more specific, that is true. The question is, are they stuck with those facts, that scenario that is described in the initial complaint, and can they never move beyond that without amending the pleadings? And I don't think that's a rule that this court wants to adopt. It's going to lead to plaintiffs being in the difficult position of needing to amend and reamend and reamend each time something new is discovered during discovery. And that's what happened here. Little was known about this overseas venture when the initial attorney prepared the complaint. It developed into something else. They got to the summary judgment stage, and that should have been the stage where everybody puts their cards on the table and the judge weeds out what's going to go to trial and what isn't. But what the 8th District said is, no, we start with the complaint and we narrow down from there. And there's just no precedent for that. This footnote 4 they have says, plaintiff's claims are necessarily confined to what is alleged in their pleadings. With no citations, this wasn't an argument that was specifically advanced by the defendants. I haven't been able to find anything that supports that. There's nothing that supports that in the defendant's brief.
Well, no, wait, you're in the Court of Appeals arguing about a summary judgment, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you're arguing you've put into evidence other things that they needed to consider.
Correct. If the 8th District said you didn't present any evidence at the summary judgment level of this fraud within the statute, they would be entirely correct to say it's done. You cannot argue that anymore. You didn't put your cards on the table when you were supposed to. In order to avoid resolving that evidence, they've gone back to the complaint and said you're locked in. And there's just no precedent right now for that idea that the complaint locks you in and you need to revise it in order to bring in new facts and new theories. All the causes of action were in there. Fraud, breach of contract. Those are spelled out in there. The defendants are identified in there. You can tell from the complaint what the plaintiffs are complaining about. It's this business venture that went sour. They had everything they needed to know to defend the claim. And if you look through the trial court level, they're not complaining that they're surprised by anything. They didn't file a motion for a more definitive statement. They didn't suggest that somehow they'd been misled. We'd have a different case if that were the issue.
But doesn't a fair chunk of your case or your discussion start out with the complaint that these defendants represented that they could get a franchise and they couldn't and didn't?
Correct.
But that was known to your client well before the statute of limitations ran.
In 94, correct.
Yeah.
That.
So why talk about that in a complaint?
Justice Piper, I mean, all I can say is that I just think to tell the story, you got to start at the beginning. And sure, if there was some fraud that was known and led to damage in 94, the statute passed on that. But that isn't what happened here. We have this incident in 94, and it was annoying for the plaintiff. They told her she wasn't going to get her franchise, but there was no damage. The business continued. Mr. Simmons said, you're not getting the franchise. You can use my name and you can use my seasoning, but you're not getting the franchise. So she doesn't have damage. And the consistent rule in this court has always been, you can't sue until you've got damage. So here we have a classic case of somebody who, there's a red flag early on, but no damage. The damage happens 5 years later in 99 when the business starts.
What case is that? You can't sue until you have damage.
The best quote I found was from this court in NCR Corporation versus United States Mineral. I cited it briefly in my brief, but then when I looked over it again, I saw how good this was. This is a quote from Justice Cook's majority opinion, and she says, and this is an asbestos case where we're talking about asbestos leaks from property. It's a property damage case. Although the mere presence rule has been adopted by a minority of jurisdictions, it has been criticized for forcing some building owners to commence suit before they have sustained anything more than a potential or contingent injury, at a time when their claim could not survive a motion to dismiss. Our reasoning in Burgess versus Eli Lilly Company demonstrates this court's view that a potential cause of action is not sufficient to trigger the running of a statute of limitations. In Burgess, we found RC 2305.10 unconstitutional because it commenced a limitations period on a DES claim before a cause of action matured to the point where it could survive a motion to dismiss. And that's her problem here. When he said he wouldn't give her the licensing agreement, she couldn't sue him because she had her business. The problem was that he could pull that back, and if she didn't have a franchise agreement, he could shut the business down at any time, but he didn't. Until that point, she couldn't sue him. And the question that the court needs to ask here is, do we really want to force plaintiffs in the position of running out and at the first red flag filing a lawsuit before there's any real harm sustained? And that was the problem in the NCR case, and asbestos case, because there's a faction of the plaintiff's bar that would love nothing more than to be able to file lawsuits when there's exposure to asbestos.
The test is no or should have known, basically, for lots of things, and that's certainly what the test was in Burgess. Do we need to modify the test in this case?
No.
All right.
I stand here just asking you to follow prior precedents. I mean, I don't need any new rule of law in order to prevail in this instance.
This would appear to be, as you know, I didn't vote to allow this case for review in the merits. I didn't see the legal issue we needed to write on. I'm still, frankly, not convinced that we need to write on something here because, as you suggest, your argument, I think, is the Court of Appeals erred. It didn't follow the law. If it's an error case, there's not much for us to write on, is there? I mean, we go through all these facts, but that's not going to help anyone in the next case.
Well, Chief Justice Moore, there's two points that are critical in this case that need to be, I guess, explored and thought carefully. The first is the topic I just addressed, which is footnote 4 in the courts of opinion, where they say you are limited to what you allege in the pleading. If you allege a scenario, that's the only scenario you can argue until you amend your pleadings. That needs to be undone. That's bad law. Secondly, the problem here is that this concept that I just read from NCR is being applied in personal injury cases. It was in Norgood, and it's being applied in property damage cases, that's NCR, but it's not being applied in breach of contract and fraud cases. And this is the opportunity for this court to say it applies to all range of common law torts. Maybe if there's a statute that says otherwise, that'd be a different issue, but no statute of limitation starts to run until all the elements of the claim exist. And here, the critical element of the claim was damages. It did not exist till 99. No amount of due diligence on Grace Kadoukas' part could have uncovered damages prior to 1999 because there were no damages. The first day she could file her lawsuit was the first day the business started to suffer. And actually, she filed it 2 years after that. We just don't want to be forcing people, business owners, partners, shareholders into the awkward position of, at the first sign of trouble, running to the courthouse and filing the lawsuit out of fear that their statute of limitations just started. That's a principle that Justice Cook had no problem with in the NCR case, and we're advocating that here. The 8th District's problem is just twofold, like I said. They focus down all the factual allegations, all the evidence, to a very narrow scenario that just happened to be the one described in the complaint, and then from that point proceeded to misapply the statute of limitations. The whole case should be undone. It should be sent back with instructions that the summary judgment motions in favor of the plaintiff, the summary judgment motions are to be denied in the case to proceed to a jury trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Harvey.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's a great honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Harvey, I'm trying to understand where the Court of Appeals went off track, if they did. And I believe the appellant's argument is the test, know or should have known the alleged fraud, and I assume you dispute that your client committed any fraud, but let's say for purposes of this case, that they may have, and that there were different frauds or alleged frauds that occurred at different points in time. Isn't what the appellant is urging, perhaps correctly so, that the fraud that they talked about in their complaint regarding the lack of getting the promised franchise, time's gone on that, and they he says they suffered no damage from that. But anyway, time's up. But there were other frauds that they learned about later, or that they alleged frauds that they also had included in the complaint, separate incidents, and that those should be alive and well, and that they alleged enough to get beyond summary judgment on the issue of the statute of limitations? Or is it that if you you enter into a contract and you learn that your partner, or you come to believe that the other party has committed a fraud, that then you're on notice and the statute runs on all subsequent fraud? Which is it? Is that what this is about?
Your Honor, in direct answer to your question, I would like to answer it in this fashion. First of all, there's a couple of misstatements that need to be corrected by my esteemed opposing counsel's opening statements that directly address your question. First is that not only was there an initial complaint in this case, but also an amended complaint. What the Court of Common Pleas did not allow was a second amended complaint within weeks of the trial date. And that's a very important point, because the appellants in this case twice stated an oral contract. Second point, there is nothing in this record, there's nothing that I'm even aware of as I represent to this court, that there's any damages flowing from the alleged non-written franchise or license agreement. Now, let me segue to your question directly. There is two aspects to the alleged frauds in this case. One is that they did not receive a written franchise or licensing agreement at the commencement of this whole Lithuanian restaurant business, which ran successfully for over 5, maybe 6 years, and which failed not because of a written or unwritten franchising or licensing agreement, but because they were basically squeezed by some unscrupulous folks in Lithuania to move out to the suburbs as opposed to where they were in downtown with a lot of foot traffic. In any event, getting back to this, the amended complaint, however, talks about, again, the fact that the appellants, the mother and son, did not receive a written franchise or license agreement, and therefore they were defrauded by the appellees. When I believe the Court of Appeals below said, so what? First of all, you ran a restaurant with everything that would have been contained in something in writing in any event. So where's the fraud? And if as a matter of law, in December 1994, you, appellant, signed a statement saying you weren't going to get something in writing. The statement of Lithuanian intent, which is one of the exhibits before this court in the record. As of that point, that 4-year statute of limitation began to run. Now, later on, the appellants unilaterally commissioned somebody in Lithuania by herself, not through the corporate entity, which still exists today, to do an audit. Now, this audit, I would suggest to this court, which is contained in the record, is 2 pages of material which is unsupportable as it relates to pinning my clients for blame for anything specific, first of all. Second of all, that auditor who did this so-called audit did not present to this court, through the lower courts, any type of Rule 56C or E evidence that was properly before the court. Third of all, the so-called accountant that took that information in this context in our state, who said, okay, this looks like a good audit, didn't make any reference whatsoever to whether or not that audit was done in compliance with United States law. He simply said, it looks like a fine audit to me. Complete hearsay. Complete lack of foundation. Complete lack of pointing to my clients to be responsible for anything that would hold them culpable for fraud. The point is, as the appellants just pointed out, we work under Rule 56 in this state. This is how this case came before the courts below. Rule 56 requires very specific evidence, and that evidence was not presented to the courts. Now, the trial court did not specify exactly what the basis for their decision was, granting summary judgment. The Court of Appeals said, however, excuse me, but as of 1998, the 4-year statute of limitations for fraud ran, and in the year 2000, the 6-year for oral contracts ran, and that's the end of the case. But assuming that we get to the actual merits of those claims, you don't still show any of the elements of the causes of action which would hold the appellees responsible for anything in this case. I don't know whether I've answered your question.
Is it true that your clients lost money as well as
the plaintiffs? I mean, everybody lost money on this deal once they moved to the suburbs, did they not?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. My clients, as well as the appellants, lost their initial investments. And actually, Your Honor, what I was going to say was, in addition to the statute of limitations, assuming we get to the merits, I suggested in my merit brief to this court that I'm not even sure how shareholders can have a contract with one another. I'm not even sure why this case would be here without as being an improper direct action as opposed to a derivative action. But I suggest to this court that, in addition, that if this court were to find a contract, that my clients met all the elements of a contract, that the appellants did not meet the elements of showing a fraud, and that they haven't established any damages of any of the claims, the legal claims. The equitable claims, I don't believe, are even in question here. But on the legal claims, the damages, what are they? There is no evidence in this Rule 56 record demonstrating what the damages are. When I asked the appellant in her deposition, which is a matter of this court's record, what the damages are, one of her reactions was, well, I'm not here to discuss the damages, okay? Then we determined that what the damages really were in essence her initial investment, just like my client's investment. My client's investment was lower in terms of dollars, but higher in terms of capital. They lost this because the restaurant failed. They all lost it. And that's what happens when folks go into a restaurant deal in an overseas country, in a communist country, without having proper foundation for what they're doing. The appellant, for example, has no experience in the industry of business and was relying upon my clients for that experience. Your Honors, I would suggest to this court that the lower court's decision was correct in all bases and that this court affirm the 8th District Court of Appeals, which affirmed the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Mr. Flower, you've saved a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, to answer Justice Stratton's question, it is not correct to state that everybody lost money on this venture. It is undisputed that in 1998, both Mr. Petkus and Mr. Masinkus received distributions in excess of $6,000. Their contributions had been $5,000. They profited just from those distributions alone.
But didn't they also do all of the work in the restaurant?
We disagree with that as well, Your Honor. The work was done in Lithuania. We have no evidence, no reason to believe that these gentlemen did anything productive. We have a lot of evidence to show
that
they
ran for 5 years successfully. Somebody had to be doing something productive.
Correct.
And seems to me that they should be paid for their labor at some point, even if they only invested less actual dollars. They invested a lot of labor, according to the record.
I'm not sure where that's in the record, that they invested a lot of labor in this. Certainly not more than my client. It is in the record that they had Lithuanian employees, managers, and so forth running the business. But that's a fact issue, and that's a heavily disputed fact issue. When we started here, my understanding was we were on the statute of limitations. And again, this complaint is much broader than the 8th District is giving it credit for. Specifically, just looking at paragraph 36 by itself, this is typical. Plaintiff further states that she relied on the fraudulent misrepresentations of defendant Robert Simmons and was induced to expend funds by said misrepresentations as well as by oral misrepresentations concerning the Mr. Chicken licensing agreement. It's a broad complaint with one specific scenario in it. The 8th District should not have limited it down just to that. Again, this decision sets bad precedent in two fronts. It should be overturned before other courts begin to follow it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.